You're both good now.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Anthony Mann, and I would like to welcome you to the sixth in the London series of seminars jointly run by the Education Employers Task Force and the Centre for Education and Industry at the University of Warwick. The series invites leading analysts to share perspectives on how employers can best engage with education providers and the consequences which follow for young people and institutions. Our speaker today is Jeremy Higham, Professor of Post-14 Education Policy in the School of Education at the University of Leeds. Jeremy is the director of the 14 to 19 research group within the school and a long-standing and influential commentator on British policy aimed at closing the gap between the worlds of work and education. His topic today, however, is Canadian. Drawing on extensive fieldwork in Ontario, his subject is work-related courses in a Canadian province, how teachers and students create a culture of vocationalism.
Thank you, Anthony. Now, you've been asked not to heckle. I have to say that's not my usual style. I really much prefer quite a lot of engagement in the seminars I give. But what we're going to try and do is go all the way through for about 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll have a discussion afterwards. There's a lot of courses in the UK that are labelled vocational, but which are not fundamentally vocational or even semi-vocational in nature. And there are quite a lot of courses that don't feature the V word, but yet are focused quite strongly and specifically on an occupation or have a strong vocational bent. I got the opportunity to spend some time abroad on a fellowship, and I decided to go to Canada, specifically because I felt that I could engage and understand the culture perhaps more effectively than other places. I've done work on vocational education in Japan, in China, Australia, Austria, Germany, etc. France, where I've taught, Spain as well. But on each occasion, I felt slightly outside the real understanding of the culture. Ontario is a state that's not dissimilar, it's a province not dissimilar to our state of England in terms of size. It has quite a lot of shared values and shared culture, despite it being in North America. So I specifically chose to go to Ontario and specifically chose not to look around at various courses and see which were vocational and which were not, but to go straight to a number of courses that strongly advertised themselves as vocational and try and understand what was the nature of the vocationalism taking place and where did it come from, how was it sustained, what contributed to it in the first place. So in a sense, I'm not going to talk about that in great detail, but I do want to explain to you, first of all, the vocational framework that I used. This is a lot of work that myself and David Yeomans have done over the years at Leeds, and we've come to an understanding that when we look at a new initiative or a new set of programmes, or indeed one single programme in one institution, a school or an FE college, that it's useful to understand the values and the culture, the aims and the mission of those who are influential within the institution, the institutional context, its background, its hinterland, its socioeconomic context, what it's about, what it stands for, what it's seeking to achieve. To look at the purpose of the programme, why does it offer this particular programme, and then what are the aims of the programme, what is the programme seeking to achieve in terms perhaps of employment, perhaps of progression to FE or HE, in terms of the young people. Is it fundamentally about engagement or fundamentally about progression to employment? And then to look at the student recruitment. Who is it for? Which students are targeted? How are they recruited? How do they come forward? The resources. How are employers engaged in providing resources? Are they industry standard? Are they directly related to the world of work, or are they just what the school can happen to afford or happen to find? The staffing, what's the background, the industry background, the occupational understanding, the expertise and experience of the tutors? What is the engagement or the influence of the employers? Are they involved in the staffing in some way? Who are the staff? What do they believe? What are their values? What are their orientations? Then the curriculum. What are the tasks? What are the activities that are taking place? Who designed the curriculum? Were employers involved in that? Were there specific values or principles that underpinned the types of activities or projects or orientations that were taking place in the classroom or the workshop or work experience. The pedagogy, to look at the pedagogy in its own right. What was fundamentally behind the pedagogy? The ways of being with the young people, the ways of assisting their learning, the ways of engaging with them within the context, the classroom, the workshop, whatever. And finally, the assessment. What were they assessed against on the course? Whose assessment criteria were they? Where did they come from? How did they relate to the world of work? How did they relate specifically to the occupation? And fundamentally, what was the role of the employers in influencing, if you like, the curriculum, the pedagogy, the assessment, in terms of being accepting of the young people who had been through this experience progressing into work? So I quite deliberately took a set of programmes that was at the end of the spectrum that looked as though they should be strongly vocational. Now, Canadian high schools have an interesting feature, a feature shared by many high schools across the world. They are not in direct competition to FE colleges. So they are teaching young people from, say, 13 through to 17/18, but they are not losing them at 14 or 16 to an FE college. So that's an absence of competition. On the other hand, the corollary is that the entire cohort is expected to stay in school and go on to graduation at age 17/18. Now, a school or a local authority, because the local authorities are quite strong as these school boards, is expected to take a strong focus on its progression achievement. And as a minimum, that's what's its graduation rate at 17/18. Is it 70%? Is it 90%? And they're aspiring for 90 to 100. If you think about that for a moment, in the absence of a sixth form college, in the absence of a series of apprenticeships beneath the age 18, in the absence of an FE college providing things, a huge onus then turns upon the school to put forward a range of provision that meets the interests, needs and cultures, if you like, of the young people for whom it has responsibility. And the schools are not fundamentally in competition with each other. It's more like the older LEA system. So it's not as though they can turn away the young people, either because they can go to an FE college or they can go to another school, but they have to make provision that's appropriate and suitable. This turns them round into thinking slightly differently about different forms of progression into adult and working life. And the school board that I was in had a board-wide set of collaborative programmes that could be taken by any student within the board, and they were called Pathways to Success. Some of them were intensely academic, some of them, I think there was one on Celtic culture, for example, or there'd be one oriented towards some quite fine art experience. Others were general understanding, learning how to play the guitar, for example. But there were within them quite a strong group of very consciously vocational programmes. At no point did I ever hear the V word. That was never spoken, never used. Vocational or technical were words that just didn't exist in the vocabulary and were almost actively denied when I tried to raise them. Oh no, they would say, we're not vocational. I would point out that in many cases, vocational was in the title of the school, a vocational institute. But this was a historic thing that they no longer had any truck with. Now, this was about pathways for success, and there were different pathways for young people. Nonetheless, they were intensely vocational in some cases. So talking about 15 to 18 year olds, we're talking about courses now. By course, I mean it's practically the entire learning experience for the young people. Not modularised or not individual subjects. This is what they do from 9 till 4 every day for a full week, with maybe half a day off to do some additional maths or some additional English. This is their course, and it lasts half the school year, a semester, or it may last the entire school year. And interestingly, they may repeat it at a higher level. and it's onus on the teachers to use the modular credits of the credit system to devise the course themselves in an innovative way. So it's a confident board. It's a board that's been doing this for some 20 to 30 years. This isn't the latest creative, innovative idea it's had. This is a long-standing, well-established set of provision. And the programmes I'm looking at are multi-credit ones. They've taken English credits, maths credits, apprenticeships credits, vocational diploma credits, geography credits, or maybe another history. They've brought them together into a course which combines all these credits. So it's a little bit similar in some ways to the concept of the diploma, the 14 to 19 diploma, or in some ways to the GMBQ, but it's at the harder end of the GMBQ, occupationally specific, and it's bringing in credits from all over the place, and it's down to the teacher to design them. And that's the key point. Not only are they collaborative, but they are teacher-led. So when I interviewed the school board members, or anyone really in the school, a principal or vice principal, they would say it's about letting the expertise of our teachers be accessed right across the school board by our young people. So we've got somebody here who is, I don't know, that they are a specialist in fine art. We have somebody here with a great understanding of some sports activity. We have somebody who used to be a plumber. We have somebody who used to be an IT technician. Why should we constrain those people? And they flipped it around and said we're going to make their expertise and skills available across the whole school board. So the entitlement was that any young person within the school board could follow any of the courses, and transport was put on and paid for by the local authority. The only restriction was it had to have school support, and there had to be at least 5 young people from another school on the programme for it to run. They weren't allowed to run it for themselves. So that was a really interesting feature. So, selection criteria, they were promoted as work-related to the young people. I had to make a judgment as to whether there was some innovative, interesting curriculum practice to look at if I was going to spend my time wisely. I wanted a range of sectors, a range of different levels and types and contents of programmes, and I took 4 months doing this on a qualitative, intensive case study approach, focusing strongly on the learner experience. What I'm going to do now is run through the 5 courses at relatively high speed and a very high level. I'm then going to focus on 2 of the courses that contrast, and I'm going to try and draw out some of the issues I want to talk about by the contrasting. So very quickly, mill writing. They would do a semester in a school, what would look to you and to me like a metal workshop, but they were doing welding, blacksmithing, milling, grinding, all sorts of different occupations that they could go into for an entire second semester. So the first semester was developing very high level specialist technical skills that would be of use to the employer when they went for a full work experience lasting 16 weeks full time. And they would get credits for that work experience, full credit for that, so that would be their year. They would get the full set of credits for the year. They'd do half the credits up to February, and they were doing specialist metalworking skills, but they were actually occupational skills of learning how to be a blacksmith, learning how to be a miller, how to be a millwright, a machinist, a welder, whatever. And then they would put those into practice in the second. Optional. Not everybody went into the optional. They might just do another programme in the second semester, but those who are interested. And I would put it to the teacher. I hear no vocational discourse here. I see you not setting them up at all for going into the world of work. I don't see any real sort of projects being brought in from the outside world of work. There were projects being brought in, they were from the community. And the young people would do jobs for people in the community, and they would follow their own interests. So I would say, in a sort of devil's advocate way, so how is this vocational? But the person running the course, who was a former millwright and still practicing millwrighting, was absolutely adamant that the best thing he could do for the the second half was not to teach them the turn upon time, all the employability skills. The best thing he could do was to give them the fundamental expertise in the occupation they were going into. And he would bat me away and say, no, they can learn all of that in the workplace. They can learn all of that when they get out there as a millwright. I need to send them out with the skills so they can cope with the tasks they'll be given when they arrive in the workplace. Which is quite an interesting take on things, but that was his view. The motor vehicle fellow, slightly different. Again, they were serving the community. The first one was community tasks, so they would do jobs for the community. Again, they were serving the community. They had four, this was a one semester program, 16 weeks, four blocks of 4 weeks. First block, get them ready for the workplace. Second block, spend an entire 4 weeks full time on work experience. Third block, back in the school. Fourth block, back in the workplace. And the workplace would be anything from a big Volvo trucks dealership through to an aircraft manufacturer through to, in the majority of cases, small car workshops and dealerships, local independent garages, working on servicing cars, exhausts and tyres and that sort of thing. Now, in the school, they didn't see the school, in a sense. In the school, it was a room 10 times larger than this, which was a garage, effectively, with full industrial standard equipment, where they serviced cars free of charge for the teachers and for the local community, who were encouraged to give a donation back to support the equipment, but actually that's what they did. And they would the concept in England of having your car's brakes serviced by one of your year 10 might seem slightly unusual. It might be tempting for them to not put them back on, but they took it very, very seriously indeed. And he was a mechanic by trade. That's what he was, a motorcycle mechanic. And this guy who taught the course had worked right across Canada in all sorts of different mechanical and automotive contexts. Not a trained teacher. House renovation. The school would take on contracts to renovate houses. So if you wanted a new bathroom or a new garage building or a new roof on your house, or you wanted a drive laying, or you wanted the entire inside of your house gutting and redoing, then you would approach the school, you'd engage in a contract, for all the, not for the labour, for all of the materials and the services, and you would agree a donation to the school. And then you would get effectively your renovation done. It might take 2 months, it might take a year. And that's what they would do. And they would do all of the jobs that exist within that, plumbing, carpentry, plastering, whatever was required, roofing, anything. House building. This was another group that would build houses from scratch, from the foundations upwards. I know you're sitting there thinking, I don't think he really means build houses. I didn't think he really meant renovate entire houses. Was he serious about them servicing these cars? Actually I am. That was the house, they were building three houses when I was there. When I arrived, that was a foundation. That's a $400,000 house that's going to be sold. And it's on an entire building site. There'll be another 20, 30, 40 of those either side, each with workers, each with full-blown industry professionals working hard in more or less total silence. That was interesting. No music, no nothing. They just worked in silence and were working against the clock, efficiently, in silence for profit. And a lot of self-employed people coming and going, plumbers, carpenters, gas, electrician coming in and doing the services while the house builders built the houses. And that was fascinating. They had built that entire house. The only thing they hadn't done was the gas, because they weren't allowed to do gas, and the electrics, because that wasn't permissible. But from the foundations being dug, to boarding, to what they called forming, pouring in the concrete, and the whole way up, they had built that house, these 16 and 17-year-olds, with this teacher. So when I was impressed, they said, oh yes, we built that church as well, they said, and pointed to a church with a spire. It's amazing. And they had three houses on the go, and I think this was the 86th house they'd built. And there were three teachers working, each teacher had a house, had 10 or 15 kids, and they just built the house together. And each of the teachers was a full-time builder, or had been, and would do construction. So they were serious, serious teachers. This wasn't somebody who vaguely knew something about house building. This was a full-blown contractor who had moved into a job, not a teacher. Third one was radio journalism. They ran a community radio station. You can hear it if you could find it on the internet. It's there on the internet. It can be heard on FM in that area of Canada. And it was a full-blown radio station that the young people had total control over, including throughout the summer holidays when the teacher was away for 2 or 3 months. They carried on doing it day in, day out, and running it. Obviously, they'd had the full year to get ready for that, but they just carried on, and it was highly professional. Very, very, very professional indeed. But it wasn't focused quite as strongly, as you can see on that slide, it wasn't focused quite as strongly on the occupational immediacy. They may go on to higher education, they may go on to further education, and then go into a career in broadcasting. It was focused on a slightly less immediate level. So that's 5 courses that I focused on, just to give you an oversight. Just to run through the nature of the teaching and learning that's taking place, I'll have to just highlight very quickly because of time. I won't explain, but I will explain in discussion later if you want. I hope you know what I mean when I say task-led, problem-based, authentic. Comes from a real-world expectation or need. It's a real-world task. It's not simulated. It's not made up. It's a real task with external consequences, or it actually takes place on work experience. Theory is absent at the start. Everything is servicing, building, making, delivering. And the theory gets deconstructed on the day there's heavy snow and they have to stay in at school, or the day it's pouring down and they have to abandon the worksite. Theory tends to be deconstructed later. The dominant mode is individualised learning, and within that, the dominant mode is the master apprenticeship model. Anthony's doing something here. He's putting something together. I'm wandering past. We have a chat. He shows me the plans. I ask him how he's going to do it. He can't work it out. I explain what we do in the industry, 2 or 3 different ways of doing it. Then I'd wander off. He would have to make a decision about which was the best approach for him, how he could achieve it. I'd then go and see what James is doing. I'd notice that James has made a great thing, and I'd just carry on wandering across to Prue. But then I might come back to James and say, right, you've finished the next stage. How are you going to market that? Made a great product, but how are we going to market it? Did you think about marketing at the design stage? And so that's quite a very, very individualised mode. The teachers, to a greater or lesser extent, but to a greater extent in most cases, but we'll see some examples of not in a minute, modelled vocational practices very, very consciously. You know, young person turns up late, 2 days in a row, they're off the course. This is what they meant by modelled practices. It was, you know, an employer put up with it once, they won't put up with it twice. Do that again and you're off the course. And somebody would leave the course, and they would really... When I say vocational practice, I don't mean the soft vocational practices. So on the building site, when it snowed, the builders would go home. They'd be allowed to, but they'd be expected to be on a Saturday morning to make up for it. That happened to the kids as well. So when the rest of the builders went, they went. But they knew the deal was 8 o'clock Saturday morning, they had to be back to fill in the time. When it got to lunchtime, which would be about 11 o'clock or something, because they've been working since early, they would stop at the same time as all the builders, and they would model what they were doing on the gangs of builders on all of the other houses. And the builders would wander across and chat to them occasionally, see what they were doing. But they were modelling the way they behaved, the way they looked, what they did, the way a mechanic was, the way a renovator was. So, health and safety, hugely strong emphasis. These were real-world consequences. You've got 6 kids on a roof, roofing. They've all got to be roped on, all got to be tied down. All of the ladders have all got to be secured. Everything's got to be checked. Not a lot of written risk assessments, but the actual health and safety when, you know, dealing with someone's car, it's always obvious consequences if you don't get it right. The assessment tended to be practical and outcome-based. And it was interesting, the Canadian word for learning outcomes is expectations. They are called curriculum expectations. Interesting use of the word expectation. The teachers had two sets of expectations. They had expectations deriving from their informal knowledge of the industry from which they came. And then they had the expectations of the learning outcomes. And I have to say that they were influenced strongly by the vocational understandings of the community that they represented. And they went through the others because they had to. But they were influenced strongly. So they saw the curriculum expectations as something that had to be met. But they had this informal set of expectations at the back of their minds that was influencing the way they assessed. So the teachers strongly had a vocational background, huge wealth of expertise, thereby an up-to-date understanding. Several, if not all, were still practicing in their holidays. They get longish holidays in Canada in summer. And they were still practicing, and interestingly, sometimes engaging the young people they'd taught throughout the year to actually pay. They would pay them, they'd be their workers in the summer in one or two cases. They would model vocational practice, and they would induct them into the community of practice, if you like. They were basically seeing the young people on the whole as inbound, and they were helping them make that journey from, if you like, an outsider to be an insider. They're inducting them into the culture. Because they had the background, because the teachers had come recently from industry or were still in industry, they had all the contacts and networks, they knew the people, a quick phone call here and a word there would open up a work experience place, also get some facilities or resources. Someone would ring up and say, have you got any plumbers you can send me? At one point I was in the office chatting to the plumber guy. I haven't told you about the plumbing course, but the phone rings. Can you send me two plumbers? We've suddenly got a big project on for some hospital or whatever, and we're short of plumbers. I want two apprenticeships. Can they start on Monday? So his biggest problem, he would lose people from his course because they would get snapped. They'd see them and they would be snapped up by industry. And they reckoned that just about, possibly an exaggeration, but it's what they told me, just about every single young person working in the construction industry in the entire big town under 25 had passed through the house building course. This was their supply chain. This was their route of. This is how they assess the young people. This is how they watch them. This is how they interviewed them, if you like. That was their supply chain, because what the building industry in Canada needs, and it's hugely. I can put this, is hugely competent and ambitious, is workers, competent workers. So there was an understanding from the big companies that they could get access to the young people. Where am I now? And finally, high levels of credibility with the students and with the employers. And the students understood that they were the real deal and that they had to listen to them because they had the insights. Now, the title of this talk isn't about just the teachers, it's about the students and their dispositions, their motivations, their identities, their desires, where they want to be and who they are. And this started with a self-selection process. It started with the course recruitment, with the course being specific about its purpose. And so the young people came in positively oriented to the occupation. So you've got a teacher who's from the world of work, from the job itself, with a group who want to enter that, and you're already on a bit of a roll because they're reinforcing the culture of the classroom, the workshop, the work experience in two ways, or three ways, I guess. One, they want to be there for that reason because they want to enter that profession. Secondly, they want to do something they've already done. What I mean by that is they worked in the summer for their uncle or their father, or their mother's got a shop that they can work in to go into the retail trade or whatever it is. They're already doing the part-time jobs and it's part of their culture. Cultural capital wouldn't be too strong. They are reinforcing. So they are part of a community to some extent with lots of reference points within the family. And I would often get taken on one side by a parent while I'm hanging around. A lot of hanging around in winter in Canada. It's pretty cold hanging around on the building site because the wind sort of channels between the houses and it's like being in a freezing wind tunnel. but your job is to watch how the kids work on the roof, and you can't just pretend you're only interested in bathroom fittings and go inside. You've got and the parents would pick the kids up sometimes, and a great big truck would appear, and the dad would get out or lean across, and they would tell me about their kids. I never formally interviewed them, but they wanted to tell me how much the kids enjoyed the programme and how they got a business, and they were hoping X and Y was going to set up as a whatever, one of these or one of those. The third one is that the course, they would come back, finally, they would come back and do the course again and again. So there'd be 2, 3, 4, 5 veterans, is what they called them. People had done the course before, were doing it at a higher level for higher credits. It's so varied. Every house was different. Every car was different. There's always different things to do. They would do the course again and again, 2, 3 times. And some of them called themselves junkies. And they would just go, they'd do the house renovation course, then they'd do the house construction course, then they'd go and do the carpeting course, then they'd do the plumbing course. And they just loved it, and they'd keep doing these courses. But that reinforced the vocational culture, because the veterans were expected to induct the newcomers into the community that they themselves were beginning to be inducted into. And that had that sort of mutual self-reinforcement. How am I doing for time, Anthony? Because I've got quite a little bit to go.
Three, four minutes.
Well, what I'm going to do then is I'm going to put the two courses side by side, rather than talk to them, and invite you to look with me the house building course on the left, students positively oriented towards construction, family and friends working in the area. On the radio course, they hadn't thought about radio. The kids there just loved music or hip-hop or whatever it was. They were there for the music. On the house building course, the tutor's a constructor. But on the radio course, the tutor had an English teaching background. He was the only one who was a teacher of those 5 courses. So he readily said things like, well, I'll read you a very quick quote. It was a bit odd for me. My background is English, not communications technology, right? So for me, that was the hardest part, bringing myself up to speed on things like sound editing software. I was always a bit of a stereo nut, but never a sound engineer. He had no reference point. He was a great teacher, and he was a huge manager, and he was a station manager, but he had no external reference point. Therefore, the workplace was simulated, absence of reference to the... I mean, simulated as in real radio station, but not in any part of community radio stations, just they did what they thought was a good thing to do. No reference to industry, as opposed to the house building people working on a house next to other houses with builders. The tasks were authentic, it was a real radio station, but they didn't really have real world consequences. They might break the terms of their license and they'd lose it, that would be a consequence, but it wasn't quite the same as a house that was going to be sold for $500,000. There was individualised learning, but there was no real sense of there being the master showing the apprentice and inducting them into a culture, because the teacher didn't fundamentally come from the community of practitioners, and so wasn't able, therefore, to bring them in that sense. The assessment on the radio was practical against formal learning outcomes. On the house building, yes, they did do the formal learning outcomes, but it was about the informal vocational criteria. And if I was to sum these up for you, I'd say the house builders, they were house builders, those kids. They were learning was becoming a house builder, entering into that culture. Young people on the radio journalism, this was learning as engagement. They weren't on their way to be radio presenters, although one or two clearly were exceptionally good and had opened their minds, and they were thinking about that sort of thing. So just to sum up, teacher background and contacts with employers and sector were central to vocational conception experience of the course, but also the students' dispositions, identities, learning and career aspirations influence the vocational nature of the course. Whoops. And that, I think, for me, is a quotation that's driven a lot of my work. Martin was one of the externals at my Viva for my doctorate, and I've always thought that book, Curriculum Making in Post-16 Education, is one of the most interesting, insightful books I've read in education. And that quotation for me, that the process of curriculum making hinges as much on the values and views of knowledge, learning, teaching, human nature and educational purposes which teachers bring to bear upon their work. And I could talk for a long time about that, but I think it's important that in this piece of research we recognise that it was the teachers who drove the programmes. They were fundamentally teacher-led, even though the students didn't reinforce it.